Hello, this is David Russell. This is episode 3 of the No Bad Bosses podcast, sponsored by Manage to Win's Dave's Charm School, a series of 14 soft skills training programs. And today my guest is Rex Frank of C-Level Ops. Now, Rex and his team work with dozens, maybe as many as 100 different companies on coaching them on best practices. So you're going to get some great insights on leadership tips and what you do when you have a dysfunctional leader, and a lot on the value of peer groups and coaching, which is not advertising for Rex, but things he gained personally. It's really cool insights. I think you'll enjoy it. Okay, this is David Russell. Welcome to the No Bad Bosses podcast. I've got Rex Frank of C-Level Ops with us today. And Rex and I are old friends. Love Rex. Recommend you all the time, Rex. I still have never heard a negative thing from anybody when I recommend them to you.
I'll keep trying.
Why don't you give our audience a little intro, a little background on what you do?
Yeah, so my career started in 1988 as a computer tech in the early 90s, got promoted into the service manager role, played that role through probably 2007 at a company down in Southern California, had a blast doing it. We embraced managed services very early. I'm talking back when we put 2400 baud modems on Novell 2 servers. You know, back when we used big 286s as servers.
Yeah.
And, yeah, a little product called LAN Alert. Had a great time with that. Got involved in a service executive peer group called TPG, or the True Profits Group, and that peer accountability group really changed my ability to be a manager and a leader. And I started running the practice, you know, based on setting business goals, setting objectives that we need to meet. Started holding each of my staff members accountable, running the practice by the financial metrics. And then in 2007, I needed to move up to the Seattle area, where I took a job at a 50-person company. They were primarily a VAR and professional services organization, where I was hired with this brand new title at the time called the VP of Managed Services to create a managed services practice. Did that for about a year and a half and hit the $1 million club. I moved over to another company in Seattle as the director of operations. And in those second two jobs in my career, I was really focusing on being a builder of managed services practices. And in 2010, December, I made the jump to founding C-Level Operations with really one core purpose in mind, and that's coaching managed service providers on achieving operational excellence. I found a niche where there's a lot of companies where an owner starts a business, grows it to about 10 employees, you know, in the computer services industry, and they stop growing. So they do what they think is best, which is usually take their best tech and promote them to service manager, which is kind of what happened to me in the early 90s. And then they go along for a year or so, and they realize all they've really done is taken their best tech and make them less billable. And the owners are still doing most of the management. And I just found this niche coaching that service manager on how to kind of take that ball away from the owner and really learn how to be a great manager, primarily by focusing on, you know, implementing operations in a very systematic way. And I leave all the leadership training mostly to David. But.
Well, so let me go back to the peer group thing. So the True Profit was like the first peer group in the IT services or managed services space, wasn't it?
Yeah, a guy named Steve Bowser formed the company after, he'll kill me if I get this wrong, but I think it was Computerland or one of those early computer store chains. He was
might
sort of a
connecting point.
A connecting point?
Might have been
connecting point, yeah.
I'm not sure. Might have been.
But he was... he was sort of a rescue guy. He came in as a general manager and rescued him from a financial perspective. And after that organization went away. He founded TPG, the True Profits Group. And my boss, Ole, was an early member of the group, along with some other industry powerhouses, right? Arlen from HTG was in there. And this is in the
That's interesting. I didn't know Arlen was in there.
Arnie from ConnectWise was in there. Gary Pika from True Methods.
Wow.
All those guys were all early buddies from the TPG group through the early 90s.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
It's interesting because as I flip through like the MSP Mentor 100, you know, where they got the top rankings, almost all of the companies that I was in there with, they're in that top 20 range. So Bowser definitely set those owners on a path for growth. That was kind of a requirement to be in True Profits Group, was you had to be commit to growth oriented. He didn't really want to work with owners that wanted lifestyle businesses. But yeah. I got to be a member of their inaugural service executives group. So that was a lot of fun.
And how about the peers you had in that group? How strong were they, or where are they today, type of thing?
You know, I don't know, is it appropriate to talk about names, or?
You can decide.
You know, there's a couple that weren't really a great fit for the group, and I don't know that you know see them in there, but one of them, Ken Sponsler, was with Connecting Point of Greeley, Colorado, came to work with me at Sea Level about 5 years ago. Dylan with Thrive ended up growing their company and, you know, standardizing operations to where they got acquired by Staples back around 2006 or 2007. Riata got acquired by White Glove, a big Texas integrator, and then they got acquired by one of the big, by Mindshift, and then Mindshift got acquired, and she stayed on as a director of services for a long time. So there's been, and then just, you know, again, I think I should leave names out of it, but the people that were in that group really went on to, like I said, be in the top 20 in that MSP Mentor 100.
Well, that's great. And how long were you in the group?
I think it was about 6 years before I moved to Seattle.
Wow. So 6 years. And so you not only had Bowser's mentoring, but you had this other stuff that was going on within, between members. Talk to us about that. I mean, how did that feel? What did you bring?
Well, it was interesting because, you know, we go to this meeting and we had to set what he called a 60K goal. We had to set a goal that over the next quarter would generate 60K in gross margin. And so that was interesting, trying to figure out how to do that. And because we had to articulate how our goal and what we were going to do, the how of how we're going to create that additional gross margin. We had to come with prepared with a best practice. You call it the great idea contest. So I think everybody had about 60 seconds to present a great idea, and we all had to throw $20 in the pot. And winner take all kind of thing. You couldn't vote for yourself when it came to the voting. Actually, I remember one of the ideas was this guy named Dan from this company called Connections for Business was presenting how to use power gadgets to read data out of ConnectWise to create a gadget. And he eventually spun off that whole idea from that great idea contest into ConnectSmart.
That's right. That's right, Dan and David.
Yeah. And anyway, we had to come prepared to share a great idea. And then there was a topic for that quarter. You know, sometimes they'd say, okay, everybody bring your client onboarding plan, or everybody bring your minimum documentation strategy. And funny story, I remember this one time, he said, okay, everybody bring your internal disaster recovery plan. And, you know, I kind of looked at it and thought, I really don't have one, but it's really not okay to show up empty-handed on a topic, right? Occasionally, for the most part, everybody should bring their best and share it, and then we all would learn something and make ours better, right?
Yeah.
But occasionally you'd show up and say, I haven't tackled that yet, so I really don't have anything to share, and you're just a taker, right? You're taking in what everybody else shares. Yeah. So anyway, I threw something together. It was kind of half-assed because I didn't want to show up empty-handed about, our own internal systems, right? We're selling this managed service, and our clients are depending on us to keep their systems running, so we better keep our systems running so we can keep their systems running, right? Yeah. And I had something that was kind of half-assed. And anyway, it comes time to share our internal disaster recovery plans, and I think there's 12 people in the room. One other person had something that wasn't adequate, and I had something that wasn't adequate, and we were the only two that had anything. Everybody else showed up to learn from everybody else, right? And it was one of the few times that I saw Steve Bowser's face turn completely red, and he was pointing at us, and he was admonishing all of us, how can we, sell a product or a service to our clients if we're not even eating our own dog food and not even taking care of our own systems? And he was just pointing, and this is totally unacceptable. I think we all showed up at the next meeting prepared.
And I think that's an interesting point, though, that in a mentoring coaching role, he felt he had the right to admonish you guys that way and kind of beat you up.
It was brutal.
And it was brutal. Yeah. But it was beneficial, right? I mean, you guys.
Yeah,
that's just it. And so it's not like you tear someone down on the personal level, but he was obviously tearing you down because, hey, you didn't do your homework assignment. This hurts everybody. And as you say, you're saying you guys are great at this, but you don't even do it internally. How can you make that claim? If he had pussyfooted around that, and not done that, that would have hurt everybody in the group.
Oh, absolutely. I can still hear there's a couple phrases from Steve Bowser that I hear in my head constantly. One of them is, now, for owners, he expected them to produce a 20% net profit. So in his owners' groups, his phrase was, is that a 20% decision? Okay, is this decision you're making going to support a 20% net profit? And for a service executive, it was, is that a 65% decision? Right? He was all over that. You're making all these little decisions all day long, and they need to be weighed against, is this going to produce a 65%, labor included gross margin? And after years and years of every quarter be asking, being held accountable to, did we hit that 65%? It's just drilled into the way I am now. The thing for the owners called a 20% club, and for the service managers, a 65% club. So if we were looking at our financial numbers, and if you hit 65%, you'd get a standing ovation from the room. So, and it's amazing how motivating that little thing of 30 seconds of the room clapping for you could be. Let's see, what else? Another one was, is that the highest and best use of your time, right? Anytime we were spending too much time acting as a technician rather than going back to our businesses and working on the business, he'd just nail us with, is that the highest and best use of your time?
So I've got a question for you on this thing. It's not only, you kind of had two things. One was a 65% gross margin. And then the other thing was this fine $60,000 of additional gross profit, right?
Right.
Those are two things. So one of the things I run into with some clients is their struggle to match authority with the amount of responsibility that they're giving their management team. So how was it with the people in that group or yourself? I mean, how easy was it for you to take initiative on your own or work through the management channels and get the answers you needed and the support you needed to hit those two targets consistently?
I think there's a couple pieces of that. You know, Dave, you know him, a good friend of mine, C-level client named Joe Cram at Solid Networks.
Oh yeah, Joe's great. Right?
He said something to me once that, you know, is making me talk about it right now. But as an owner, he said, I'd like all of my key employees to have a peer group and a coach. And I don't think my career would have developed like it did without being in that peer group. And yeah, basically having Steve Bowser as my coach, because he held me accountable. But being in that peer group, I got to see people that were better than me as leaders and managers doing what they do in the exact context I was trying to do it. And, you know, when I came to one of those meetings, I wanted to not only show good results, but I cared what those guys thought about me. And it drove me to learn from them, learn from Steve, and do a better job. And that peer accountability for me, and I don't know if it's the same for everybody, but for me, it was a big motivator to, you know, there's a moment when you're at work, you're doing your day, and you get to make the decision. Do I spend the next hour working on improving a process and getting it rolled out, or do I spend the next hour fixing that thing that the client needs fixed? And, you know, there's a, knowing that I had a peer group coming up that I was going to have to stand up in front of the room and say, did I make my 60K goal or not? Or, you know, because we set other goals as well. But knowing that I was going to have to go to that peer group and say, I did not make it, I get a red or a yellow instead of a green, it really helped me focus on highest and best use of my time.
And so in your peer group, you were there 6 years, 12 people, you had some turnover. Over time, did you kind of move into the middle or the top end of that group where you were one of experienced, helping
There were different topics, right? So on the topic of managed services, I was sort of the top guy that everybody was chasing.
Okay.
You know, I think I had that very well built out compared to the rest of the group. But at the same time, there were other topics where I was chasing other people.
Yeah.
And I think I tended to focus more on those, you know.
So this reminds me, you know, a year or so ago, we had talked about whether we should do peer groups together, and I'm not looking to promote anything or anything like that, but here you have an experience where this peer group really helped you. Why aren't you doing peer groups?
You know, there's some political part of the answer there. Part of the answer is I have a very good relationship with HTG, okay, Heartland Technology Groups. I'm a sponsor of theirs. About 30 to 40% of the revenue from C-level comes from our participation in HTG. So I think that most of it is a political answer in that I don't want to compete with one of my biggest sources of new revenue. I think the second part of the answer is, you know, what I'm seeing in my head right now is the In-N-Out Burger menu, right? They got three things. They have a cheeseburger, a hamburger, and a double cheeseburger, right? A double-double. Yeah. And I have a desire at C-level to really stay focused on picking one thing and being great at it, and that's operations coaching. It took some work because I had some meetings with Scott, you know, or I don't know if meetings, but definite hallway conversations at different events. But I said, look, I need my C-level service managers to be able to be in a peer group, even if their owners are not members of HTG. And either you can put together some service executive peer groups that my clients can be, my service managers can be members of without the owners being members, or I'm going to have to do it by myself. And they decided to allow that. Maybe they didn't want to compete with me. I don't know. They're sort of the gorilla in town, but yeah. That's probably not it. But they did. They allow now service executives to be members of their service executive groups without the owners being members. So that kind of opened the door for my clients to join. And that, so between not wanting to compete with a big source of income and really just not wanting to run one myself because I want to stay focused on what C-Level does great, and them allowing those members to join, it just was an easy decision.
Well, that's good. That's good. And then, so with the peer group, what type of interaction did you have with the peers or with Bowser in between those quarterly meetings? And did you have four quarterly meetings or three?
We did three. The I think that kind of allowed, we didn't meet in Q4, I think because most of us were going to IT Nation. So we were kind of seeing each other there. I think the biggest thing was best practice sharing between meetings. We didn't have any organized phone calls or anything, and I know HGG tries to organize phone calls between the meetings, but it was mostly just email, you know, hey, I got a question about this. You throw an email out to the group and somebody have an answer. But then we had a lot of fun at the meetings.
Well, yeah,
it was a good breakaway.
Yeah, it's a good breakaway. It's a bonding thing. You know, you get along, you follow up with each other. There's friendships that, you know, it sounds like you've kept for a long time, which is natural. But, you know, talk about your work now. Now, how many people do you have on your team?
Well, it's myself, Ken Spontler, and Chris Butler. Actually, those guys are partners in C-Level now. And then recent additions are Jay Hokey. He's in North Carolina. And then working for me about 75% of his time is David Shaffrin, which I don't know, some people may know him. He was one of the founders of Cogent Growth Partners. He's having a good time doing operations coaching with C-Level.
That's a good group.
Yeah.
That's a good group, yeah.
And revenues are good. I'm a happy guy.
So I know you focus on the service manager piece, but of course it overlaps. Can you talk to me a little bit more about my earlier question about how do you, when you're working with these service managers, help them really take control of what they need to get done and not get held back by a leader who doesn't respond to their emails, doesn't meet with them regularly, or has some other dysfunction where they can't get the answers they need or the authority they need, and yet they're still supposed to produce? What do you do there?
You know, I talked to the owner about that, and in almost every case, the owner says, I wish they would just grab the ball and run with it. Right?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's better to say you're sorry than ask permission. And that there's a little bit of that, and I'm not saying go crazy with that statement, but there's a little bit of that I think a good leader just grabs the bull by the horns and starts riding it. And, you know, one of the things, here's a big problem, is this service manager person will go to their boss and say, hey, I've got this problem, what do I do? And part of my coaching is with the boss to say, don't ever answer that question. And with the service manager or whatever manager, don't ever ask that question. Right, I want him to go to the boss and say, hey, here's my problem, here's what I think I should do.
Right.
Right? So if the manager goes to the owner and says, what should I do? The owner really only has one reply, which is, what do you think? Okay? And based on that answer, the owner has only two possible replies. One of those is, that sounds great, run with it. Or, have you thought about?
Yeah. And that leads me, oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, go ahead.
No, it just leads me to your best practices. So you've got, you know, what is it, 87, 88 something best practices. How does a leader balance implementing best practices with getting all the daily stuff done or other things that are tugging at them?
Yeah, it's highest and best use of your time is what comes into play there, and understanding the answer to that question. So for those of you not familiar with the C-level methodology, I operationalized implementing operations, right? And that's sort of why C-level is successful. And I organized them into 10 categories. The first category is get your ConnectWise configured. Right, so in there, and it could be Autotask or get your PSA configured to be more accurate. But there's, you know, we got to get your business unit set up. We got to get your billing rate set up. We got to get your agreements in. We got to make sure there's hard costs in there. There's all these things around getting that initial stuff set up. The second section, I sort of refer to it as the life of the ticket. What's your process for triaging a new ticket, dispatching a ticket, entering time on a ticket, reviewing the ticket for quality control, and then closing the ticket. The third section is measuring KPIs. How are we going to measure? Are people following these processes correctly? And you know, what are the KPIs we're going to manage? And the fourth section, I call it service team human resources. And in there, we have some bonus plan, engineer bonus plan stuff. We've got org charts, accountability charts, job descriptions. That's sort of kind of getting that HR stuff, a PTO request process. The fifth section is what I call leverage your tools. We need to have a standardized way of documenting every client the same way. We have to leverage the RMM tool that you're using so that we're using it to do all the things that it can do. We need to have a standardized patch deployment process. We need to have a standard process for checking backups. And there's all these tools that you guys use. We need to make sure we document. This is how we leverage them. The sixth area, I call it get your accounting systems in order. That's making sure you're getting your agreement invoices out the same way, the same time every month, all your time and materials invoices, your ad hoc product invoicing, your procurement process, leveraging your quoting tools so that you're creating opportunities in a way that they can be converted into procurement, the whole procurement process, standardizing the way that you do a credit memo and doing those accurately so that it does all the reporting correctly, that you're backing time billing or product billing out or putting the inventory back in inventory the correct way when you do the credit memo. The seventh section is what I call client-facing systems, right? That's new client assessment, client onboarding, your client touch plan, the way you do your quarterly business reviews with your clients. It's everything in the way the client interacts with you, and primarily focused on the ways they interact with you on things other than they have a problem because something's broken, right? So section 8 is what I call get ready to grow. And it's interesting because a lot of section 8 is where I would refer people over to go talk to manage to win, right? That's goal setting. It's in, you know, how you do your one-on-one with your employees. It's the hiring to manage
well,
to
I
win.
Don't know.
But it's hiring process, right? Right. And I know we want to know your company core values so we can measure against your hiring process. All these things need to be figured out. Employee onboarding, training programs. Like what kind of a training program are you going to put together? And that's when we start talking about CERTL, right? So that you can manage your vendor authorizations and stuff. So then section 9 is all about marketing, right? All demand generation. And C-level's not the marketing experts, but there's processes around getting your marketing stuff in order on a cycle. And then sales. And that's where we focus on lead conversion. and, you know, sales comp plans and organizing how a salesperson is going to leverage the engineering team to bring sales in. But there's 87 different processes that you need to, every company needs to figure out how they do that. And then there's five phases. I think that's a term that C-level uses a lot. And phase one on any process, let's say you're going to tackle your client documentation process. Phase one would be to reach out to every source you have to try to understand the best practice. Right? C-level has best practices, True Methods, ConnectWise blueprints. There's best practices all over the place. Phase one is to go learn how other people are successful. Phase two is to take that information and document it the way your company is going to do business. And that's what where a lot of people, either they don't do that step or they don't give it enough attention. The third,
is there a pretty wide variance on how they're going to apply it in their organization? Can you give me examples of the variance? Because I think I know the answer. There is some variance there, but can you give me some examples on a particular item?
Well, let me get through my five phases, and I'll go back and answer that question.
Sorry.
So the first phase is understand the best practice. The second is document your way, right? Whatever your way is to do it, get it documented, flowcharts, Word documents. And we do that for a couple of reasons. Number one is I always find it makes sense in here, and then you try to put it on paper, and you realize it doesn't make sense. So the process of getting it on paper is how you figure out really how it's going to work. So the third phase would be train your team. So I want to say, hey, guys, this is how we're going to start doing it. This is when you start getting buy-in from your team on the new process, especially if you're giving an opportunity to comment and maybe even upgrade or change the process a little bit before you implement it. The fourth phase is the implementation, where you're actually making the changes and configuring your PSA and starting to do it the new way. And then the fifth phase is the hardest and longest. It's the inspect what you expect. So how are you going to make sure that everybody's doing it the right way so you can go into that iterative cycle of inspect, oh, they're not doing it right, and then coach and train and coach and train, and then inspect, oh, they were doing it right, but now they stopped, so you need to do more coaching and training. And so to get back to answering, and by the way, that's the hardest one. That's the one that you feel like you're just trudging through the mud.
But doesn't that one pretty much never end?
It doesn't, especially considering that almost all those 87 topics you have to revisit as your company grows. Right. Yeah. So one of the things I talk about is, you know, when you're five employees trying to grow to 10, you got one person doing quoting, purchasing, and scheduling. So they have to communicate reasonably well with themselves, right?
Yeah.
When you're trying to go from 10 to 15 or 18 employees, now you got one person doing each of those things. So we have to start leveraging the tool differently. And our process has to be different.
Yeah.
And then when you start going above 30 employees, then you've got multiple people doing each of those three things. Right? And so you can just apply that to every practice inside the company. So sometimes companies engage with C-level and we get through one cycle, and just when it starts to feel like maybe we're done, it's if they're growing, which they should be, it's time to start all over.
Yeah.
Because
yeah, well, that's good.
And one of the things I like to say is we don't want to set you up to be the 50-person company, because the administrative overhead would sink you. But we want to set you up to be the next size so that we remove the barriers to growth so that they can grow through that barrier.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a barrier when the owner's running everything and he's trying to get a service manager involved. And then there's a barrier when the service manager is finally doing a good job, there's a barrier when they need to start to add sales. And then right around 35 employees, there's a barrier where they have to start to introduce middle managers. And all going through each of those barriers is very upsetting to employee satisfaction.
Okay.
So you asked me a question a few minutes ago about how does the manager make progress when the owner doesn't know how to do it or isn't doing it or isn't giving them authority, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the answer is in sticking to the process, right? You look at that list of 87 things and you decide this one's the most important for me to work on right now. And you very systematically put it through those five phases, and it's a safe way to make change in the organization. And because you're doing it in a safe way, the owner's not going to have anything to be upset about. And they're just going to see that wow, that person grabbed the bull by the horns and got it done.
And that's a good thing. It's exactly what we want.
So basically, my suggestion is just do it, but do it in a systematic way.
Yeah, keep the boss informed as you go.
And keep them
informed. Even if they're non-responsive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Give them a chance to say no, stop. Give them a chance to say no, stop. But other than that, grab the ball and
just
run
go
with it.
Yeah. And you mentioned Bowser was tough. So your coaches, how tough are your coaches when they see somebody that's doing something wrong?
Brutal. We have a line in the C-level core values that says integrity. And there's two separate sentences that describing that. One of them says we always act in the best interest of the client. Okay?
Yeah.
And right below that, our core value is we say what we think regardless of the impact on C-level's revenue.
Yeah.
So everybody at C-level is empowered to say exactly what they think, even if they think it's going to upset the client.
Can you give me an example without mentioning anybody's names?
Yeah, I've called out more owners than one. You know, look, when you come in the office and have your little outburst, you completely demoralize and demotivate everybody around you. And if you're going to keep coming in here having your little outbursts, we might as well just disengage. I've said that one more often than you could think.
Yeah.
I've told owners, you know, respond, not react is something that we do a lot of coaching around. You get a call from a client that's all upset about something, and granted, that story sounds terrible, right? So they just go and start going off on an employee, and after they go off and calms down, the employee tells the owner what really happened, right? And and then now the owner's in a bad spot because he really shouldn't have done that to the employee. And, you know, respond, not react is one that comes up a lot. I've told owners, the reason you're stuck is you're not making a big decision. You're dragging along a deadbeat partner, and your hands are tied, and you're never going to break out until you get rid of that partner. You know, and they don't want to hear it. You know, they don't want to hear it. I've told them, to get rid of bad clients. You know, your tech has 173 hours a month to work with, and each of those hours you could be billing $150 for, but you've got this client that for whatever reason you won't let go of, and it's consuming 70 of your engineer's hours at an effective rate of $35 an hour, and you've got to get rid of that client. And they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear get rid of revenue because they aren't associating it with bad revenue.
I recently had a client that, you know, one of their management team just said, hey, we just want you to come in and candidly tell us where we are and what we need to do. You know, and that, so it's not just the owner that should hopefully have that attitude, but usually even more, the management team underneath the owners really wants that. You know, just tell us what we need to do, the changes we need to make. And, you know, they typically have less sticky fingers to hold on to those clients or whatever it might be that are painful to, you know, making a hard decision. Hey, you know, this one's not profitable. It's not working. We need to let it go.
There's a complacency. If I just don't deal with the problem, maybe it'll get better next month. And they need to hear, not, it's going to be the same next month, you know, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
And at times, are you doing that also, recommending, you know, removing employees or putting them on performance improvement plans or something along those lines?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an advocate of, you know, obviously praise in public, admonish in private. But once you go into the I'm having to admonish you process, there needs to be a lot of clarity. Here's why it's happening. Here's what needs to change. And if you don't change, here's the path you're on toward termination. And but nobody wants that, right? But it has to go from, hey, we're all working together. And then it just nosedives over into, okay, now you're on a path where if this behavior continues, you can't work here.
Yeah, and you talk about best practices. I mean, that's one of the systems that we teach is, you know, that performance improvement process, because, as you say, they just want to have a casual conversation or make a comment and expect the employee to change. But that's not the way it works. You've got to be formalized. You've got to be structured when it's crossing the line. You've got to set the boundaries.
Yeah, I think, David, you've seen the presentation I do on my top five operational mistakes.
Yeah, I love that presentation.
And number three is, like, here's how I would do it, is we'd have some big thing go on at a client, and, you know, we would totally overreact, and I'd write a process, and I'd email it out to everybody, and talk about it in the next staff meeting, and then think it was, like, this was my mistake, is thinking that now everybody would magically just do it this new way, and all the time, and then... then I would just be completely frustrated and upset for the rest of eternity that people weren't following that process from that email I sent 9 months ago.
That's right. It's that follow-up process. Mm-hmm. Kind of what you were talking about, the step number five of, is this working and coming back to it and that type of thing. Really the follow-up, follow-through. That's probably, you know, I used to say years ago there were two major problems I saw with leaders. Number one was not setting clear, measurable objectives. And number two was lack of follow-up. And I think the lack of follow-up is a huge, huge drop for people. So anything else you want to add before we wrap up? I mean, I think this has been really good for people.
Get a coach if you don't have one. I'd love what Joe said. Peer group and a coach just helps everybody get better. Your coach better, you better have a relationship with your coach where he can say what they think. And you got to take your defensive hat off. You know, that was one of the things that was really tough for me, is I'm pretty opinionated. I want it to be my way. And it's a character flaw maybe on me, but I had to learn when I was doing my employee one-on-one meetings, sometimes I would even tell them, hey, I'm taking my defensive hat off right now because I want to hear. I want to hear what the roadblocks for you in this company really are. Yeah. Because my instinct was always just to say, oh, you're wrong because. Instead of saying, okay, they sense that this is a real problem for them. What do I need to do to help remove that barrier, right? And that is so hard from this guy. But I think with some coaching from my coach, I got a little better at it.
But that's consistent with what we're talking about, of not reacting but responding. And the analogy I came up with is, I call it, when you're that manager that just, you know, is negative and expect someone to respond and remember, you're basically playing whack-a-mole at the arcade. You know, they kind of pop their head up and you just whack them and you expect them to remember that. And then you move on with the other stuff that's your priorities. And it's not effective. And I actually have a coaching client, a service manager right now, who's taken that to heart because he's an all business type of guy. And he's changed his approach and it has radically transformed the productivity of his team. And he's enjoying it more. But he's like, wow, this is really new. I never even knew you could do this. It's a total change. So,
yeah. Okay. Just the other day, I heard one of my relatively new service managers took a couple of his employees out for his engineers out for beers afterward and, you know, kind of let the guards down and just hung out as one of the guys, and big difference at work the next day.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be. This guy's saying, yeah, I got texts answering my phone calls off hours that weren't answering before. And I got things happening that weren't happening before. And it's a big difference. Yeah, that thing. So, Rex, I wish we could just, you know, keep talking. And my understanding is you're going to be out towards my way here in Sisters, Oregon. You're going to be in Redmond. When is that?
Early April. I think it's the 9th. My kids race the BMX bikes, and there's a national down there. So we'll drag everybody down there and spend a few days competing.
Hey, if you would please let me know when you do that, I'd love to bring the kids over to watch.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I think they would love that. I mean, particularly our young boy that we adopted, Isaiah, would probably get a kick out of that, just watching that. He has no clue on BMX at all. So that'd be great. Make sure you let me know, okay?
Okay. Well, I'll be there April 9th.
Okay.
That whole weekend, Friday afternoon, Saturday and Sunday morning.
Okay. Well, I'll take a look. I'll make sure I mark it on my calendar. But thanks so much for being with me. It's always valuable. It's always good input. And, you know, I love what you do. And never hesitate to contact me if there's anything I can do to support you. But, I continue to recommend you all the time. You guys, you and your team do great work, Rex. Thanks.
Vice versa. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. We'll be back next Tuesday with Rick Norberg of Vertical 6. He's a very visionary leader. I think he's going to have some insights for us that will be interesting, challenging. So I hope you can join us.